Welcome to episode 36 of Gallifrey Public Radio. This week we wander for hours wondering if it really was a left at the library and a right at the pool or vice versa. We're talking Journey to the Center of the TARDIS. But first, your hosts. I'm Jay Witten.
We need somebody who is more intense.
And with me are Melissa Mazza.
Perfect Whovian name.
And Keir Hansen.
The jockstrap of Rassilon is formidable and large.
Spoilers.
We will be discussing news and rumors, as well as episodes that have already aired. But if we get into anything too serious, don't worry. We'll warn you again. Welcome to episode 36 of Gallifrey Public Radio, where we keep seeing reruns of past podcasts leaking through, and the future ones are extra crispy zombies bent on destroying us. I am Jay, and with me tonight are Keir. How's it going, Keir?
Very good, sir.
And Melissa. How's it going?
Great. How's it going?
Awesome. So we have experienced what the highly anticipated Journey to the Center of the TARDIS. Whether or not it lives up to the hype is open for debate. But what did you guys think about it, Keir? What was your impression on this episode?
Well, in general, I mean, I came at it, as many Whovians did, with a certain amount of expectations. As much as we tried to keep those expectations at a minimum so that anything we got would be enjoyed. And I did enjoy it. But I think this was an episode where you could enjoy it and tear it apart at the same time. Mm-hmm. I think just because of the inherent nature of the way the script was structured and some of the things they were giving us, we were getting a lot of gifts, but we were getting a lot of problems at the same time. So I'm sort of mixed.
Right. What about you, Melissa?
I agree with Keir about how, you have to keep your expectations at a minimum, I was saying last week. So I was actually pleasantly surprised with the TARDIS kind of stuff that we got. Because I said, I was keeping my expectations as low as possible. So I really liked that stuff. In all, I think this was the most compelling episode this season. And I'm not sure if that's, it's a good thing, but I don't know if that makes it the best episode, I watched the whole episode through and then did a John Locke from Lost. We're going to have to watch that again.
Yeah.
As soon as I knew that I had missed some things, there were some great Easter eggs for the fans in this episode. So I liked that. But I can definitely see some people had some kind of issues with it. So what did you think about it, Jay?
The first time I watched it was different from the second time. I watched it the first time. And as soon as it was over, I was like, this is my favorite episode so far this season. And I actually still stand by that. This one felt more like what I wanted the rest of the second half of the season to be. But I was definitely a lot more excited about it after that initial watching. Once I sat down and watched it again, once I started to pick it apart, it didn't hold up as well as my initial, yay, more Doctor Who. But it was... For me, there was a lot more to take out of it than there was to pick apart. I think this is one of those episodes that we're going to look back on in 5 years and realize and think this was great. This is going to be one of those episodes that ages really well. It's not going to be one that people hold in high esteem right now, but it is going to be one that people are going to look back on and be like, that was a really good episode.
That's valid. It seems to be a very very common reaction from a lot of the people that I've spoken with about it too, that got through the first the shiny viewing the first time out, and then really wanted to go back and see it again because of the nature of the way the script is structured. It's one of those things where you want to go back and see you wanted to see it, since that there were these breadcrumbs of the time doubling back on itself that you wanted to see. You wanted to catch it with the knowledge of how it concluded. But in doing so, in seeing it again, you start to see a lot of the stitches.
Yeah.
So that's I think we should head with this.
The first time I watched it, I've got to say that initial moment when the Doctor was threatening to blow up the TARDIS. Mm-hmm. I mean, Matt Smith did really well, because not knowing that he was faking it, I was like, holy crap, the Doctor is going dark again. I mean, I was fully bought in. I was like, he's going to destroy these people if they don't help him.
Okay.
I actually wrote in my notes, the Doctor is finally acting like the madman with a box, because he seems crazy.
And it really brought it out that, I mean, he's like creepy obsessed with Clara. I mean, it's nothing in the world matters beyond her. And it's like, okay, seriously, dude, tone it down a little bit, you know?
Maybe I didn't fall for that. I think it was because as soon as he shifted the amount of time that was given on the quote unquote, self-destruct.
Yeah.
I knew that there was hinky business going on. It is very valid that he considered her to be the greater salvage, as he quoted it, you were salvaging the ship. I'm here to salvage the girl.
Yeah.
And that was legit. But the imminent danger of the self-destruct was kind of gone for me after about the first minute, because he didn't really stress that point at all from that point onward.
Yeah, it wasn't so much the self-destruct that I was worried about. It was just the intensity that he used when he was threatening the guys. That was the part that really got me. I was like, dude, that's messed up.
Little technical note, taking it just from the top of the episode, and it was one of the reasons why I remember when we came to this latter half of the series, they were talking about redesigning the interior for very specific technical reasons. Yeah. I loved the 360 walk around the console.
Oh my god, a nonstop tracking shot. Yeah.
It was like two complete circles they walked around. I was like, that was awesome. I loved that.
Very cool. So pleased to see that paid off, because it was, for anybody who knew what they were seeing, they were really, as we were, really impressed at the fact that they were able to do that and have the entire crew hiding behind the camera.
And then the fact that, you were able to show like Clara running in from downstairs and the doctor coming in from a different angle and just being able to see the control room as a whole and not like, hey, look, we're back on the soundstage. It's like, it really did make it feel more like an actual ship.
Yep. It seemed like when we were getting those multiple levels, it reminded me quite a bit in the sheer height, physical height and scope of the set now, as much as, as far back as they could pull the camera and how much you can get within a single frame, reminded me a lot of the Torchwood hub.
Yeah.
A little bit.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't think about that at the time, but that's definitely, it does bear some similarities, yeah. Hmm. All right, so before we start tearing this episode apart, because, it's going to happen, let's talk about what it is that we did see of the TARDIS. Let's focus on that for a second. And, we did see far more of the TARDIS than we have before. Most of it was corridors, but it was actually done properly this time. Like, I didn't mind the corridors nearly as much.
As far as switching it up so that it didn't seem like we were just running different angles down the same stretch of set.
What did you guys think of the claim that this ship is infinite? Like, I knew that she was bigger on the inside, but
I think that was more just his way of summing it up and being like, I don't have time to explain this to you, so I'm just going to say that, it's infinite. It can always change. You can always, start off on one side of the ship and keep going or whatever.
It's been established that in terms of dimensions or construct, the ship interior is infinite because of its dynamic nature.
Because it can change,
Yeah.
So it's not saying that it's, bigger than the universe. It was just, that was his way of saying, simplifying it for the people that, he didn't have time to explain to.
Well, still, I think that's a big claim, though, that that she could be, feel infinite or whatever,
Well, look at what she did after they got the, once he stole the fuse or whatever, they walk down the hallway and wind up in the same spot. So in that instance, it is infinite. They can keep walking the same direction and never get anywhere new.
Right.
So, it's just a matter of phrasing at that point.
Yeah. Again, we're getting back to relative dimension.
Yeah.
That dimension, it just depends on what scope you're trying to accept it or that you can process, or what she chooses to place you in.
So, all right. I know that everyone has been really amped to see the pool. It was like really a backdrop. That's what we're getting.
Threw it in.
It looked like an awesome pool. I was like, wow, I would love to go hang out in that pool. But, it was just kind of like, oh, wait, they're expecting the pool. Here, put the screenshot in.
Yeah.
Well, that's all they needed, honestly.
but the pool was just a novelty. It had no function.
they could have done it so much better, or left it out entirely and just like made reference, like while they're running down the hallway, have Clara like glance in a door, like not show it, just have her see like, whoa, there's a pool in there, and then like, you know, continue with not showing it.
Yeah.
Yeah, that would have been better, or had them make a comment about it or something, instead of just like, you know, it was just a generic screenshot slapped on there, just the same way with like the observatory.
Mm-hmm. Like, kept expecting to see the penguin room and things like that.
I mean, obviously we couldn't have possibly seen nearly as much as we would like to, but I felt like it was just kind of like, all right, well, here's a couple things to throw that, you know, shows that there's stuff in here, and we're going to focus most of this in corridors and the control room again.
Well, with a couple of exceptions, you know, and, oh, yeah. and the few rooms that we got a little bit more time in were ones that had practical application, you know, namely the library, the everything room, you know, if you want to, however you want to refer to
the room
to
of
it.
Requirements or whatever.
Exactly. So, but take those in particular. All right. And I know we wanted to keep from starting to pick it apart, but it's going to happen as we discuss this. The room with the tree of everything, or as they want to refer to it, the architectural reconstruction tree,
the TARDIS tree of life.
Exactly. If that is the one of the core complements that allows or one of the manifestations of how the TARDIS can do its reconstruction or can do its self manipulation from the interior, then why did it not defend? Why did she not defend that room more stringently? Why did she let one of the brothers in there in the first place, only to lock him in once he, you know, tried to take one of the circuits off the tree? I mean, talk about telegraphing.
Yeah.
It seemed like they let that go.
Yeah, it definitely felt like there should have been more, like, you know, higher security. It's just he was able to just waltz right in there, and you know, there weren't any defenses at all. It was just like, oh, well, you know, I'll try and stop him if something should happen, but I'm not going to try and prevent anything from happening. It did seem a bit ridiculous.
What kind of sensor is he carrying? What kind of sensor says everything? Everything you could ever want. Well, how do you, little sensor in my hand, how do you know? Smart-ass little sensor.
Yeah.
that got to grab me. Although, backing up a little bit, another one of the rooms that we saw was just that quick. It wasn't a laboratory. It was like a storage room. You noticed it had the doctor's crib was in there.
Yeah, and Amy's TARDIS.
Yeah, and all those nice little elements. That was always kind of cool to see. That was like the stockpile of this past season's props.
And I wanted to see so much more of that. I would have loved to have had, like, you know, 30, 45 seconds of her wandering around in there. That was the biggest tease. It was like, oh, look, there's stuff. No, wait, scare her out. It's like, oh, come on.
That's where they could have done a lot more in nods to classic Who, and mm-hmm. had some great props in there that she was stumbling across. Not
there was an
stuff.
Umbrella. Was the umbrella her umbrella, Clara's umbrella from Victorian times, or Seventh Doctor's umbrella? Because I've heard both
neither.
Online.
Could
neither?
Tell.
No, it was neither. Because the Seventh Doctor's had the red question mark handle, and this was more like bamboo kind of thing.
Oh, yay.
So... yeah, it probably was just the one that they used in Hyde.
Yeah,
I've taken a closer look at the one that she shook out when she tossed the thing aside. But no, that was one of the rooms that I was more interested in. I mean, granted, the library was impressive, although I do, and I know you all kind of picked up on this too, because damn near everyone who stared at that cover for a minute thought about this. Okay. History of the Last Time War. Who wrote the book?
Yeah, that was my question, is who the heck wrote it? Clearly it wasn't the Doctor. You know, he wouldn't jot that stuff down, so it wouldn't have been...
And put his own name into it.
Yeah, that's the thing. I was like, okay, he wouldn't have written it down and put his name in there, and then tried to hide it from everyone, be like, here, I'm writing it down so no one can find it. It's like, yeah, no. So
or
who
is
the
this a self-penning, you know, tome? That just, you know, that is only created and only read within the TARDIS's library because of the nature of what it is. It's how records are kept. But if that's the case, then why do we have the liquid encyclopedia?
Yeah, I mean, that honestly, that kind of, I mean, it was kind of a cool idea, but that felt really Harry Potter to me.
Yeah, I need a pensive.
Yeah, exactly. I was like, it's not quite what I was expecting from Doctor Who, but okay.
Although it did give us a moment to have, you know, some nice little voice clips and things.
Yeah. Cool. Like, and all right, when the dude was tearing the console apart and you started getting all the little audio clips again.
Yep.
I mean, that was really cool hearing all those.
I noticed Amy Pond going, "We are in space." there's 9 in Rose, I heard. And then I saw online that there's Ian and Barbara from the very first episode, Third Doctor and Joe. And when 11 was from Idris, which I did not hear that.
Yeah, I got to go back and watch it again with a better set of headphones next time, try to get some of the subtle audio out of that. But that was fun.
Yeah.
That was pretty cool. And
now, for a second, let's jump to the other, the concurrent storyline here having to do with the brothers.
Yeah.
This bothered me in a good way. I mean, this, I think, was a valid B story to have running under this. Far more compelling, in my estimation, than the Lava Zombies of Time.
Yeah.
Which I'll get to later, because talk about something to pick apart. Man, that thing.
Honestly, I felt like the brothers were not even necessary. I think this could have been a really, really good character episode had it just been the Doctor and Clara trapped in the TARDIS trying to stop the engine from overloading for whatever reason. If they had just focused on the Doctor and Clara, built the tension between them, and then at the end had the payoff of the Doctor confronting Clara, it would have been much, much richer instead of trying to cram these three people into there and have a secondary storyline that's basically just detracting from what should have been the main focus.
Well, and I think that they did not flesh out that storyline enough to justify keeping it in the episode. I want to actually read from, this is on DoctorWhoTV.co.uk. This Clint Hassel was the author. But he brings up the point of, so there's these three brothers, and are we to believe that Tricky never questioned his continuing to need to eat, breathe, or use the bathroom? Has he not cut himself shaving and realized that he does in fact feel pain? Further, why does Tricky continue to recite his no fear, no hate, no pain mantra, even using it as logic for Gregor to cut his arm off, while grimacing in pain from being pinned to a wall? It says, is he this dim-witted? If so, then I question his dad's decision to not make him captain of the family salvage vessel.
Yeah.
So, like, really, you're absolutely right. Like, this could have been cool characters, but, like, really, it makes no sense the way that they act. And, you know, the way that the Doctor reacts to them, like, he normally, I don't know, like, there's been other people that he would definitely, like, excoriate and just scream at and stuff, and in this he's just like, all right, whatever, you know.
Exactly. Yeah, and that's something that I had noted, is that I felt that they didn't really get the kind of the lashing that they deserved for the stunt that they pulled. I mean, who subjects their own sibling to this kind of torment for the sake of a joke?
Yeah,
and for who knows how long.
I think it was a good storyline. It could have been a really good storyline. It just didn't feel like it should have. It didn't feel like it fit in here. It felt like it should have been something else.
Mm. Yeah. Well, I think, and this is kind of going to where I sort of leapfrogged a little bit earlier, because they ended up trying to split the attention or some of the premise of the episode into three components. You've got the danger of the TARDIS. You've got the danger of the brothers, you know, bent on tearing her apart. And then you've got the time zombies. I think if they had consolidated a little bit, left the zombie aspect out of it, which was a complete failure, and used that opportunity and that screen time to flesh out the brother story a little bit more, I think the brother story does have some merit to it. Because it's an instance where, remember, the Doctor is the one who actually points out the need for humane behavior and response. It's an interesting point coming from him, who is always the one being reminded of the value of humanity. Yeah. So it's got some merit to it.
Yeah, I mean, it definitely it was a good storyline. I would have liked to have seen more of it. I just felt like it took away from what should have been the main story in this one. Mm. You know, I mean, if they had taken those guys out and left the zombies in as just a way to build tension, and then made the focus between the Doctor and Clara, and you know something wrong with the TARDIS, yeah, that could have been a really, really good story. But the way it was like there was too much, and they didn't put enough effort and focus on any one thing to really right. make it worth it.
It all felt very, very rushed.
Yeah.
Agreed. They tried to cram too much into this episode. But I don't think that you can get rid of the zombies. I think when you start realizing what they are was when the episode just took a turn for the fracked up. Like, I was like, what? Like, this episode completely changed. Like, oh, that's them, but like burned.
But
you know, like it
what?
got really
why?
Dark really fast. Yeah. And, you know, they're still alive and their eyes turn red for some reason. And like,
why are they suddenly? And you saw that when time rectified itself and merged the two brothers because they touched and so forth, and they suddenly, you know, transmogrified into these lava zombies, they suddenly wanted to kill.
Yeah.
What is going on? I mean, I understand the whole idea of, you know, we need our secrets. Don't ask any more questions. But no, I'm going to ask a few questions.
Yeah.
Because that don't make no sense.
I don't know.
And he knew from the get-go, because the first time he clapped eyes on him, I'm so sorry.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the Doctor knew right away what was going on, and yet, you know, couldn't bother to tell anyone else, be like, hey, be on the lookout for something that may cause this to happen to us so that we can prevent it.
And that's just it, us, including him. Hello? Yeah. What?
Yeah, but he didn't even realize it was him until at the very end.
Well, when he sees his hand on his face and he says, yeah. Oh, that's my gesture. But why would he, you know, if he's in that kind of an imminent physical threat, hello, regen? What? I don't...
Exactly.
I don't get it.
Yeah, I don't know. That was definitely, had they put more time into trying to explain that or making it feel more realistic or at least more, you know, put more explanation into it or something, it could have been a decent way to build some tension. But yeah, you didn't have enough time with any one element to make it worth it.
Yeah, the rift is a nice big broad brush.
Yeah,
to just glaze over. But it does make the one thing that I'm gonna continue to try and balance out, because it's inconsistent, you know, with the nature depending on who's penning the episode, is can we come to some sort of consensus as to when the timeline can and can't be interrupted?
Yeah. All right. So that actually brings up something. Soleil wrote us this week, and he was asking, you know, in the Ninth Doctor's Father's Day, we establish that you can't interact with your past self lest the Reapers tear the world apart. Yet in Journey, we see the Doctor directly interact with his past self. Shouldn't the sky be filled with Reapers? And yeah, I was talking to him about it, and I said, you know, the Reapers only showed up in that one episode, so to try and put them as a constant is difficult.
Yeah.
But yeah. The thing I was thinking about is look at every other – because I've complained about that. I'm like, okay, so Rose can't touch her baby self, but Amy's running around holding Amelia's hand and everything's okay.
Right. Mm-hmm.
But I was thinking about it, and every time you get that, every time you get something that should bring the Reapers on, if you look at it, you know, the Pandorica in this one, you know, anytime like that, time is already severely messed up. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, the world's about to end because time is falling apart or whatever the case is. So what can the Reapers do to come in? They're like, oh, I'm going to come fix this paradox, but the rest of it is, you know, whatever. Yeah. So it could be that, you know, they can't correct major temporal disturbances. So
well, what could be more of a temporal disturbance than the very core of the TARDIS, you know, starting to disassemble?
Well, what it seemed more like was that, you know, if you touch your past self, it creates kind of a paradox. And so they might just be there to create, you know, to correct that form of paradox. And we haven't really seen that except if everything's already foobarred. Yeah. So I don't know. It might be a little bit of hand waving, but that's the best I can come up with because, yeah, it's. We haven't seen them since then, but we haven't really been in a situation where that's the only problem with time.
Right. And the only the only cover I can put on that is the fact that this is happening within the TARDIS interior, and that all bets are off, because even the very laws of physics tend to break down to a certain degree, because you've got literally you are as close to, you know, with the star at the center of, you know, about to go, you know, supernova or collapse into a black hole, you're starting to harness a singularity within.
Yeah.
So, and we all know from all of our basic, you know, astrophysics courses that I'm sure we all took when we were going for our doctorates here, that the laws of time and physics break down as you approach a singularity.
Yeah.
So, okay, I'll let that go.
Yeah, the math adds up. Why not? You know.
Yeah, sure. Well, you know, but it just seems, again, yeah, you said it yourself. It's a matter of, you know, who's got the pen in their hands and how much of hand waving are they really going to allow themselves when they're moving at this pace.
Yeah. So,
well, hold on. You brought up the Eye of Harmony. Can we talk about that for?
Yeah. I was actually going to say this is the second week in a row that we've had a reference to the Eye of Harmony. You know, last week he said that he had a fragment from the Eye of Harmony or something, and then this week obviously we see it. And it's like, I can't help but, you know, think that there might be something to it. I mean, when we've got back to back like that, when the last time we heard about it was the 96 movie with Paul McGann, you know, I think there's something to that. You know,
right.
Could it be that they're building up the whole Eye of Harmony thing, and you know, we might get the Master back trying to get back to it, because that was his plan the last time it was brought up?
Well, apparently it was first introduced in The Deadly Assassin, which is a fourth Doctor story. And the reason the Master wants it is to restart his regeneration cycle. So I'm wondering if somehow, you know, there's the whole idea that the Doctor only has a certain amount of regenerations left. What if he uses this to unlock the rest of them or whatever?
Mm. Yeah. Possibility, yeah, because the Master's already accomplished that task.
Yeah.
By hook or by crook. In this particular case, I don't know. I'm not really sure why it suddenly has come to the forefront again, other than the fact that that it is an immediately accessible. We've been locked away from literally time locked away from a lot of the other sources of Gallifreyan temporal manipulation. You know, and as far as the artifacts of Rassilon and all the different things that we used to in Classic Who rely on every couple of weeks, you know, they say, oh, well, there's the jockstrap of Rassilon, and there's the, you know, the locker combination of Rassilon, and the blah, 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 blah. So, yeah, you can save that one. The jockstrap of Rassilon is formidable and large. A new soundbite.
Phrasing.
Exactly. But since we don't have those, you've got to look to ones that are still within reach, literally. So maybe they kind of had that backdrop as they were, you know, putting these episodes together, and a couple of our writers sort of tapped into that same premise. Might have been coincidental, but we know there's no such thing as a coincidence in time. I don't know. I don't know if it goes with the regen theory, but it definitely has to go with the fact that that they're bringing to attention the fact that there's still a lot of tools of power at his disposal, which may be needed for something a little later on we haven't gotten to yet. Begging the notes that we have towards new developments in the 50th
right.
coming about. But one of the only last things I had here with regards to this episode, and it really wasn't a matter of picking it apart. It was just something that maybe I didn't catch the couple times that I watched it. All right, so Tricky, you know, there's some horrible accident in the past, lost his eyesight and his speech, so they gave him bionic eyes, gave him his voice box. His brothers decided to be right bastards and convince him he was an android because they thought it was funny.
But you know, like you do.
How does he? One of the first points when they bring the TARDIS in and they drop her in a pile of cables, he stops them for a moment and says, "Can't you feel it? Can't you feel her?" You know, his sense of empathy towards the TARDIS is something more than just having a couple of bionic eyes.
Yeah. Well, I think honestly, humans have felt something to it. Like, you know, Clara immediately like personifies her. So
yeah, she can tell, you know, it's like she doesn't like me. So
Yeah, so I don't think it's necessarily like a machine understanding a machine kind of thing. I think it's just like the TARDIS gives off this energy that people respond to.
That he's just more receptive to because his brothers are right bastards.
Right.
Right.
Yeah, and that's, you know, they kind of make reference to that later on too when what's his name, the real dickish one, you know, he gets on his case and he's like, you know, you always take the side of the machines. And so, you know, clearly this is something that's happened before. So it might just be that he has more, you know, he feels, you know, ostracized and has a personal connection with the machines or something. It's,
yeah, possible. Yeah. Well, I can float with that. But then who's a bigger bastard? Bram or Gregor, for what they've accomplished. You know, Gregor's the one who's kind of responsible for doing some of the disassembly, and he's the one that we're screaming at the television as he's tearing the console apart. But, you know.
How stupid can he be?
Yeah, I thought it was kind of weird, though, that they, you know, when Bram dies, Gregor's just kind of like, oh, yeah, no, he's done. He's dead, whatever. You know, just.
Yeah, wrote him off so quickly.
Oh, yeah. But then when Tricky gets hit with the rod, you know, he shows some real hesitation to do anything. Like, he's like, you know, he cares for him clearly. And it's like, wow, I can tell who your favorite is.
Yeah, big brother versus little brother.
Yeah. I mean, he was just real quick, like, nope, he's done. Let's move on. It's like, wow. Mm. So, yeah, all right. So it looked like when Bram was coming down the ladder, mm-hmm. his hand hit like a scratch mark or something, and that's what burned his hand. But then, like, Clara saw the scratch marks on the wall and actually ran her fingers along it, and they were fine. Like,
oh, I picked up on something different. I thought he brushed up against a cable behind him that shocked him and forced him to drop.
That was it. I don't know. It was hard to tell what was going on at that point.
Yeah. But, right. I thought he brushed up against, because there were cables running down the center of that downward corridor that he was traversing, and I thought that he might have, you know, like the idea of a brushing up against the tentacle of a jellyfish or something. And, yeah.
Maybe that was the case. I don't know. It looked like it was as soon as he put his hand on that spot that looked messed up is mm-hmm. when you heard the sizzling and whatnot. But
oh, okay.
I mean, I don't know. Clearly, they did not know what they were doing with the cinematography. Gosh.
I don't know. But, yeah, it's all in all, you know, it definitely gave us enough facets to, I mean, we can say that we can enjoy it and still want to dissect it as well. And that can be the mark of a good episode, even if it has its flaws.
We do that with every episode, regardless of how we feel about it. So it's,
sure. Yeah.
Yeah.
So I liked at the end when the doctor finally came clean to Clara. Yeah, when it felt like something that was being, it should have been built to a little bit more, but something that we've been waiting on for a while now. And when it finally happened, it's like, thank you for finally saying something.
Yeah. In which instance, which revelation are you referring to?
When he first says, you know, when he first tells her that she died again, and that was kind of like the, oh, yes. And then, like, he keeps on going and she keeps questioning him. And it's like, no, say something. Yeah, but it was that initial, like, okay, something's going to happen here because he said something.
Right.
But then when they're standing in the chasm area or whatever, and he actually confronts her, he's like, okay, so what are you? We're obviously going to die. There's no sense in hiding it. Now, what the heck are you? Mm-hmm. Yeah, that I felt like at that point it kind of – I don't know if it took the creepy out of the obsession so much, but it was like – okay, at least now he's not hiding everything from her.
No, I think it's problematic.
Yeah.
Insofar as the fact that now, all right, well, and I'll pose this. I'm going to turn this around and give it this right back to the two of you to kind of chime in on. How much of this has been wiped clean from everyone's memories on the reset? Because obviously there's been changes.
Well, yeah, I mean, the doctor told Clara that she's not going to remember. She's not going to remember the library. She's not going to remember the book, anything like that. So, but then we see the picture on there, you know, see, clearly Gregor remembers a little bit because he's nicer to the brother. Mm-hmm. And we see that the picture, which had Tricky ripped out, is actually whole. So, I mean, there's a physical change. It's not just memory.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, clearly the doctor remembers what happened. You know, because he starts questioning her. It's like, how do you feel safe? He doesn't come out and say anything that gives it away, but you can tell he remembers.
But I don't know if he remembers everything.
Yeah, it may not be a complete remember, but he's got more information than anyone else at that point.
Yeah.
It may just be an impression, a feeling or something, but the only other thing that we see is Clara saying that she's exhausted. So.
Yeah. Well, then that kind of brings me back to the concern that I have, which is, you know, we've been told, we've been spoon-fed this Clara mystery since she was introduced. And this was going to be the big deal. This was going to be the mystery to be solved by the time this series wraps up, in a couple more episodes. And now, as the viewers, we now know, or at least we've been really led in every sense to believe, that there's really not that much to it. It's a little weird. You know, you've run into her a few times. We're not really sure why. But she's no big threat. She's no risk. And now the characters may or may not remember that, but we know it, which is really, I don't know. It makes me feel like anything that we get now is going to be really anticlimactic.
This is what I've been afraid of from the beginning.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it seems like sometimes that does happen, where they build this big thing up, and like, you know, with Series 6, when they kill the Doctor off in the first episode, and the whole series is like, you know, how did he survive? How does he get through this, or whatever? And then it's like, oh, he was hiding in a shape-shifting robot. And it would have been cool had they revealed that in that episode, or in the next episode or something. But waiting the entire series, having it all build up to that point, you're like, oh, eh.
So but even that was a little better, because they kept the reveal until the finale.
Yeah.
But now it seems like they're dipping their cards early.
Well, did I miss something? Because I don't think that they really revealed anything.
Well, they proved that she doesn't know what's going on. That's
right.
That's really all we got out of it, is that she has no clue what he's talking about. So she's not obviously out for him. She could still be a sleeper agent.
Well, that's my thought. You know, his or whoever's theory it was about the great intelligence could still hold up. You know, she doesn't know.
Yeah, and I still think that it could, but I'm just saying that now it's going to feel like you already brought that up like twice and shot it down, and now you're going to bring it back and say, surprise, it really was that all along. It just feels odd.
Well, all right. I know that this has nothing to do with this episode, but I did read a really entertaining theory about Clara, and it was that Oswin was the original iteration. And she didn't die on the when the asylum blew up. She actually survived in Dalek form, however, and then later becomes the Emperor. And that kind of shows why the Emperor was so obsessed with turning humans into Daleks, like, you know, creating Daleks out of human DNA. Mm-hmm. Then we get Rose filled with the time vortex coming to destroy him, but she's got the whole time vortex in her head, and she sees what's going on, and she realizes how badly the Doctor is going to need Clara. So when she scatters when she destroys the Emperor, she really scatters Clara through time to encounter him in whichever way. And then, you know, she's the one that gives Clara the number to call him for tech support.
I can see the connections, but that's a pretty deep pull to double back on.
Oh yeah, I never said I believed it. I said it was really, really entertaining.
I like the idea of Rose being involved.
Yeah, and it would explain why she's kicking around for the 50th. Yeah. But then even that would be a little unusual, because we've been told emphatically just within the last week that we're going to see more of her, more iterations of her. And that we'll get the answers in the finale, not the 50th. We'll get it before that.
Yeah.
So by the time the 50th actually comes around, we'll have that at least answered, not resolved, answered. And we go forward from there. But I don't know. I'm thinking all I need is one more dip into the great intelligence basket, and I will feel that I'm still on track with my potshot theory. It's been a little quiet. But
yeah, but I mean, this is kind of what we expected, was that they weren't going to, you know, have it all throughout. We might get one or two references, but it was really just going to bookend this part of the series.
So I'm still kind of feeling like this latter half of the series doesn't have it doesn't have a through line. It doesn't have, you know, if the Clara mystery is really it, then they're handling it very unusually, and it just doesn't seem like enough to kind of be that thread to run through. I kind of miss having, you know, the all-encompassing monster or the ongoing battle with the master or something that kind of pieces a lot of these together as we get towards the end of each season. You know, that drive.
Yeah. I'm kind of glad it's not just another monster. But I agree that they're handling it really differently than normally. Not sure I like that.
Yeah. I don't know. Maybe we've been getting something all along that we've just not been picking up on, you know, and there have been Easter eggs in there that we're just not pulling out of the baskets, so to speak. I don't know. I'd be really impressed if that's the case, if suddenly, you know, he comes along and says, well, you didn't notice that in every room they walked into, there's a little green blob over in the corner, and you didn't see that little green blob. Oh, the little green blobs.
We're going to get something where they reveal that, you know, Claire has been there the whole time, and then it's going to go into this, like, 3-minute montage of, like, clips from every season coming up to this, and they've got digitally inserted Jenna Louise Coleman in the background, you know, kind of like they did with Jack Black's character in Community. It's just kind of... always there in new footage.
Womp womp. Well, but all in all, you know, an episode that's definitely got our interest and our discussions peaked. So it definitely served that purpose.
Yeah.
And you do get, you know, I went back and watched it at least 3 times now, and every time I was, you know, sitting closer and closer to the TV and listening with the sound farther and farther up, so I could catch little things.
Yeah,
this was a little gift episode, I think, more so than anything else.
Yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm. I mean, you say it's a gift episode, and I think that makes it. I think this is like a neat little bookend to The Doctor's Wife. Right, and that felt like a gift to us, and it was a better gift than this one.
I don't worry. Well, that brings up my last really, really sticking point. I didn't really want to get into this because it was just going to make me kind of angry. Because the last time I discussed it, it got me really angry. But screw it, it's near and dear to my heart.
Let's go. Come on, bring it.
The relationship between the Doctor and the TARDIS is probably the most near and dear thing to me out of this entire program, and the fact that the TARDIS is his perfect companion, you know, through it all, you know, and yeah. There's moments and there's lines of dialogue in here that start to allude to that, but it drifts away very quickly, and it drifts into an area that I'm personally not very happy with, and that's all the references to the TARDIS as this sort of feral creature. You know, she's snarling, you know, or, you know, you don't want to see a ship get angry, and like, you're treating her like an animal when you've worked so hard over decades to make her sentient and intelligent, hyper intelligent. And now, and you've gone beyond personification. And in one case, you've given her human form, and now you're backpedaling and saying, oh, you know, in the last episode, oh, she's like a cat. Or in this one, oh, she's snarling because she's angry and she's defending herself like a wounded animal. No, guys, mistake, big freaking mistake. I really got my, you know, the hair up in the back of my neck when they started doing that in this episode.
Well, I think that, yeah, the snarling comment was kind of a sticking point for me. I was like, I don't like how that fits into it. But I think the bookend comments that I got out of it were pretty good. You know, when Clara says, you know, you're like a guy that can't date someone without his mother's approval or something, and, you know, clearly talking about the TARDIS, and it was like, I like that because, you know, the Doctor was like, you know, trying to pat in the console. He's like, it's okay, you know. And then at the end when they're in the engine room with it all exploded, you know, you can see he's really distraught. And he makes the comment. He's like, she's always been there for me. And now it's my turn and I don't know what to do. And I think with that one, it's, you know, if you look at it the right way, it's, yes, he could be, I mean, someone could feel that way about their pet or something like that. Yeah, but given everything that we know about the TARDIS and the Doctor and their relationship, that's not what I looked at. You know, I looked at it like he feels, you know, like he needs to rescue her. And yeah, you know, it felt more like the personal connection between the two of them.
And I did see that in certain lines. It just seemed very inconsistent. And it was the inconsistency that bothered me, because I wanted them to pick a tone and stay with it. But with him going back and forth between referring to her in those terms and then flipping and using these analogies to describe her that were so far removed from that, it didn't click. It didn't jive.
Part of that could simply be the fact that we as viewers have formed a relationship with the TARDIS ourselves, whereas everyone else that's coming into contact with it, you know, doesn't have that knowledge. They don't understand that she's a sentient being or whatever. You know, it's if you walk up to someone on the dock tomorrow and they're like, "No, this is my boat," you know, and she's, you know, this hyper intelligent being that can solve all the world's problems, you're going to look at them like they're nuts. But if they talk about it as a beloved object or even as a pet, you kind of understand that. And I think that might be what the Doctor's trying to do, is introduce them to the concept of the ship as something more, instead of just going off the deep end being like, you know, and treating it like a human being or something. You know, just kind of get them used to the affection before they really can understand what she really is.
But again, Clara's already kind of made that leap for herself.
Exactly. Yeah, she's come around to start to understand TARDIS as being far more intelligent, capable, and powerful than you know. Even though she likes to joke about her as an appliance and that sort of thing, it's all done as at this point as a kind of a jibe, you know. Mm-hmm. Especially, you know, the fact that it has come to her personal aid on more than one occasion at this point.
Did you guys watch it on BBC America by any chance?
No.
There were commercials, like, that brought to you by Starbucks. They do the interviews with people on the show. And Matt Smith said about the TARDIS, like, the TARDIS and Clara's relationship. She's like, "He's my doctor, man, back off." The Doctor kind of likes that, I think. So Matt Smith is playing it like the Doctor is enjoying the catfight between.
But that's fine because at least still that keeps it that keeps the personification forward. It was the fact that within the episode and the differences in the way that the TARDIS was being referred to were coming always from the Doctor's mouth. It was his, well, the way the script was composed, his lines that were jumping back and forth in the way that she was being spoken to or spoken about. And often the only other person within the scene was Clara. And as you mentioned, you know, Clara's already starting to come to the realization of the greater nature of the TARDIS. I don't know. It's going to continue to eat at me because that really, really felt like, you know, a left turn on the highway for me, as far as the way that they had been treating her and speaking to her and about her within recent episodes.
I don't know. I think that I'm ready to hold out and see how it plays out, you know, in the next few episodes, if at all. Mm-hmm. I'm not ready to write it off at one episode and say that, oh, clearly they're not doing this right. But yeah, it is something that, you know, anyone that's been a fan of the show for any length of time, you know, does have that connection with the TARDIS. I mean, mm-hmm. when, you know, I'm very glad that at the beginning when Bran was trying to break into her, and clearly they didn't want to damage the prop, but, you know, they never show him hitting the TARDIS with the hammer. And I was happy about that because I was like, no, don't hurt her.
Yeah.
And my wife had the same reaction when she watched it too. She's like, what is he doing to her?
Yeah.
So we're very protective over our TARDIS.
Yeah. Yeah. Which is, I guess maybe that's why, because since I knew that she was going to be the focal point of this episode, that I was expecting more of a more intensified personification, mm-hmm. you know, and, you know, granted the communication can't be there. She doesn't have her means to be able to speak back, but through her reactions and responses and her treatment of the occupants, I was hoping to get something a little more than, you know, she's snarling.
Yeah, and I think that was just the fault of the writer in not viewing the TARDIS properly when he was writing the script, or, you know, possibly the director. If you have the TARDIS in mind as a character instead of as an object, then you're going to write her very, very differently.
Right.
And so I think that just may be what it is that we're seeing this writer's interpretation of what the TARDIS is and not what the overall view of her is supposed to be.
Yeah. No, I'm seeing that. Well,
all in all, I think it was a good episode, and I think it's one that's going to become a fan favorite later on down the road. Mm-hmm. I'll have to
because it does give us this much to play with. Yeah,
I'll have to come back in like 3 or 4 years and re-listen to this podcast and see if I was right or not. But you know, for now, no one can prove me wrong.
Fair enough.
Well,
closing thoughts on the episode itself? Is it within your top three so far this season?
For the second half of the season, yeah.
Oh no, I'm talking about series seven in its entirety.
It's definitely in the top five. I don't know. I think that it probably is in the top three. I don't know. I haven't sat down and ranked them all as a lump yet, but yeah. The initial reaction I got out of this, the initial enjoyment that I got, hasn't really been all that dulled by looking at it too closely and seeing some of the chinks.
Okay.
What about you, Melissa?
I mean, I think my top three would probably be from the first half of the season. Just off the top of my head, I would have to say Asylum of the Daleks, which, you know, some Clara love there. And Angels Take Manhattan, but I feel like that number two or number three would still be from then. So I don't think, like you said, I don't think that this would make my top three, but top five, definitely.
Okay.
Kira?
Asylum of the Daleks was, I would still consider to be the jewel in the cap right now as far as the series goes. I was also really happy with Hyde, actually, and would consider that to be, you know, potentially one of the tops there, along with Angels Take Manhattan, for sentiment reasons and things like that. But just in terms of the nature of a good, compelling, tight script where the dialogue is strong, the action has a good pace to it, and it's just a viable plot, I would say those three are the most solid that we've had to date.
Yeah.
Maybe Cold War is in there as well as a sort of a distant fourth, but that's just because it was a nice little canned episode. We'll see. We've only got three to go.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, we have a lot more information about the what's coming up, and I seriously think that from here on out, every week, we're going to wind up talking about the 50th anniversary. I mean, they keep on trickling out more and more stuff, and whether it's awesome or not, you know, we keep getting new stuff about it.
Yeah.
We've got official confirmation from Doctor Who magazine that there's not going to be any of the classic Doctors in the 50th, which we've heard time and time again, and so it's like, it's not a surprise at this point. It's just yet one more source coming out and saying it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, at this point, too, looking at their production schedule and what they've been laying out and the pace that they're getting, the taping done, you know, if somebody hasn't stepped forward at this point and said, you know, I've cleared my schedule or no one has shown up on location for these things, I wouldn't have had any real reason to believe. You know, we've had enough of them already say or have been, you know, forcibly tapped out than to suddenly start including them now. So this, yeah, okay, yeah. I saw it coming.
Yeah, but some of the interesting things coming with the production schedule that they've got is that this past week, actually just the past couple of days, we've had a lot of stuff coming from Freema Agyeman and Noel Clark tweeting and taking pictures together, saying that they're hanging out with old friends and things like that.
Yeah, I was trying to make sense of that, and some people were responding to the tweets and the Instagram posts they were doing, trying to get them to say, okay, are you on location somewhere, or are you, you know, can you give us any more than this? And their actual, you know, where they were sort of meeting up, and it was just within, I think, like the last 2 days.
Yeah.
And they haven't responded in anything to that. Freema tweets very seldom. You know, she's got like the account's been active for a couple of years, and there's maybe 200 tweets to her name from her official Twitter account.
Yeah, she's still very new to getting in there, because she was saying when she came over to America that she didn't realize how big a deal social media was until she got over here. So she's just recently started getting into it. So, yeah, I mean, there's very little that we're getting from her, but I mean, this is one that, you know, the Twittersphere just blew up about.
Well, didn't Noel Clark tweet this, though?
Well, both of them. Yeah, she did first, like 2 days back, and she said something about, you know, I'm going to meet going to work with old friends, and then posted some picture of the two of them in a park someplace, and then the next day were the pictures taken from, I guess, his camera or whatever. They were doing selfies of each other.
Honestly, though, this looks, not to rain on anyone's parade, but this kind of looks like Washington Square Park, which I know she films Carrie Diaries in New York. So.
Well, no, because within the same day she was tweeting about, you know, the traffic in London and things like that. So it was.
Oh, okay.
I sleuthed that much together.
Yeah. So much, you know, not really much solid information, but plenty of fodder for rumors and speculation.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And it makes sense if they're, you know, they're not bringing back the classic doctors, at least. Yeah. Bring back some classic.
And we do know that UNIT is going to be involved in the 50th.
Right.
Because obviously we've got the return of Lethbridge Stewart. So, you know, and since they are representatives of UNIT at this point, it would make sense to have them, you know, at least some sort of a walk on. So.
Yeah. But before we get to the 50th, we do have the upcoming series finale, which is getting a lot more attention now.
Yeah, especially with the new title and everything that goes along with it, and the promotional posters and the, all the magazine discussion about, you know, are we actually going to get the name of the Doctor? Do we really want the name of the Doctor?
Yeah, I mean, there's full, like, protests going on, people standing out there with signs saying, we don't want to know his name. It's like, this is Moffat that named it. I don't, you know, look at Let's Kill Hitler. You know, it's like, you get that and you think that, oh, it's going to be a whole episode about them hunting down Hitler. And he was in it for, like, 3 minutes. Mm-hmm. You know, so just because he calls it the name of the Doctor doesn't mean Jack, you know. But he did actually come out talking about some of the things going on. And one thing he mentioned is he says, we'll also find out what makes his new companion so impossible. And there's a surprise that no one has gotten right so far.
Mm-hmm. I mean, he would say that, though.
Well, yeah, but that's kind of telling, though, that he's going to say that no one has gotten it right so far. It's, you know, that's kind of a bold claim with all the rumors and or the theories that have been going around, to say that, yeah, no one's got it. Because, I mean, that's a very public statement. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I think that he's actually being truthful in that one. But that's kind of intriguing.
Yeah, it's, well, he said quite a bit. I mean, in terms of his interviews, he's been dropping. I wonder how well he choreographs what he's going to say to which sources. Mm-hmm. You know, obviously he practices very carefully about, you know, what he's going to discuss. But in terms of saving up all of his little tidbits to share this with this magazine and this with this newspaper and this with this, you know, blog site and whatnot, because did you look over, I guess, and I wish I could get a copy of this more quickly than I could if I were over in the UK, but the latest issue of the Doctor Who magazine is out, and obviously it's got this nice interview with him, and he's dropped all kinds of information on them in that regard. Mm. About, you know, and I'm going to take this by quote, because it's just the best way to be able to just throw it all out there and say, this is as much as he's giving us, and every piece of this is a potential landmine as far as a viewer who's anticipating. Mm-hmm. This is, all right, so quote, we've only just finished shooting the actual completed ending. Okay. Mm. Take that very careful phrasing for what it's worth, by the way. It's ridiculously secret, but it's quite a thing, hopefully. There's often an element of throwing in some lovely names and then figuring it out later, but I've always had a sort of a plan for the Doctor and Trenzalore. Hello.
Yep.
Things will be resolved. Things I've left hanging in plain sight and sometimes not in plain sight will be tied up. Trenzalore.
Yeah. Yep.
We've been waiting for this since the series started.
Oh, yeah. Was,
I mean, ever since the conclusion of Series 6, you know, we said, okay, well, are we going to get there? Is this going to happen?
So we're going to find out, you know, the first question is going to get asked, the, you know, what the fall of the 11th means, all this good stuff that we've been, you know, praying that it's going to get resolved, but fearing for our lives that it won't. Yeah. So the fact that he's bringing this up is incredible and saying, okay, I know what I'm doing.
Mm-hmm. Well, and that's just it. And how much of it is him just sort of playing with his choice of words and, you know, the things that will be resolved? You know, I don't know. I honestly think it's going to be, as you said, a matter of the title being aptly named, because it was just the working title. I mean, that we just fell on this within the last couple of weeks. It was going to be something wholly different a month ago.
Yeah.
Which leads me to believe that it was not the linchpin to the whole episode prior to this.
Yeah. And I mean, ever since Let's Kill Hitler, I mean, Moffat has really been paying attention to the names of the episodes and trying to give them sexy names and stuff. I mean, just look at Journey to the Center of the TARDIS. I mean, that's filled with all kinds of promise and hope. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So he's paying very, very close attention to what these episodes get named.
Right.
And they're not always a big deal. I mean, Bells of St. John was a reference that took all of like 15 seconds to get resolved, mm-hmm. and had nothing to do with the rest of the episode. So I'm not putting too much credit into the names of what's going on. I mean, this is not, you know, the Doctor and the Ice Warriors kind of names anymore. Yeah. You can't discern what the episode's going to be about just because of what they call it now.
True.
So, but I mean, we do have, you know, that all that's coming up. The Clara storyline is going to get resolved, and I mean the
answered, not resolved. Yeah,
okay, yes, answered. But, you know, we've got Moffat saying that, you know, he's actually come out and said the Doctor hasn't met Clara just 3 times. Mm-hmm. So, you know, are we going to get more answers coming up? You know, we might get answers in the finale, but, I mean, how many more questions is he going to throw at us now?
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
It's like, okay, this version of Clara, we know what the deal is with her, but we don't know anything about, you know, these 17 versions that we've just found out about.
I hope it's not that bad.
I don't know. Let's see.
I like the idea of the Groundhog Day loop where the Doctor just keeps waking up every day and Clara dies in a different way. You know, I'd laugh hysterically.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know.
Oh, my God. You killed Clara.
You bastard. But we've got, I don't really think we're going to get much, you know, knowing what we have as far as the episode next week. Seems to be very encapsulated. You know, we're going to be, you know, dropping back in time again. It's actually being told from Vastra and Jen's perspective, looking at the Doctor as a third person. So it's a slightly different sort of a camera take on that, you know, where we're not necessarily going to be able to get into the Doctor's head too much. He's really sort of a secondary character, which is interesting. But I don't think it's going to propel things.
Well, I think that the fact that we're returning to this time period is going to set off the whole Clara thing. You know, we're going to start getting a lot more information because, you know, I think that they're going to wind up running into Clara and saying, like, how are you still alive? And Clara's going to be like, what do they mean? How am I still alive? And, you know, so it's going to give her a lot of questions that the Doctor is going to have to wind up answering.
Mm. Okay. Well, there are one or two things that sort of hinge off of this. I don't know if you had noticed, this is going back a little ways, back months ago, actually. There was a toy convention where they had a couple of new, the BBC had sanctioned a couple new Doctor Who props and replicas and toys and things, and there was a very unusual sonic screwdriver that had been released that had to... Okay, you're not familiar with this?
No, I hadn't seen this.
Okay, I'll share some pictures. I'll make sure that we post it as well, because I actually came across one at a comic shop in New York a couple of weeks ago. I'm gonna call up the label here if you bear with me for a second while I do this. It essentially, what we were seeing was was a screwdriver that had been assembled from iterations or pieces over different time periods. We had one from Victorian, one from present day, one from a third time period. I want to say that it was a future point. And as a result of some situation, this screwdriver had to be assembled from pieces through time. I want to do it justice and actually, explain exactly the way that it was described. It was just very unusual. I thought it was just a toy, right. And that it wasn't really going to mean much of anything until somebody had given me some sort of an allusion to the fact that there's a reason for this that we haven't come across yet. And then if you noticed that the time periods that we had been given for some of these recent episodes, the fact that Crimson Horror is happening back in Victorian, we've got obviously a couple of present day episodes, and Nightmare in Silver takes place slightly shifted future and involves Cybermen. So there's some idea about some techie involvement in that regard as well. That this could have some merit to it, and it wasn't just a toy that they put together for the hell of it. I'm still trying to grapple with that. Because the other thing that they had released at the time was a weapon that was a hybridization of Dalek and Cybermen technology.
Hmm.
What?
And it was supposed to be able to cause a small scale or encapsulated time locks within a close proximity. So these two things kind of hit the market around the same time. And I believe you could find them both on Amazon right now if you go out and do a little hunt for them. But it was the write-up on the back that was really kind of throwing me, and I'm still digging for the damn things. I got them lost in my file system here. But talk amongst yourselves. I'll drag them up in a second.
Well, the other news that we got is obviously a few weeks ago or a month or so, some recent past, Caro Skinner did step down as the executive producer for Doctor Who. We did just find out this week that Brian Minchin, I guess.
Exactly.
He's the new executive producer. So he's got his credits before he's worked on Doctor Who, he's worked on Torchwood and Sarah Jane Adventures. So clearly he knows this world. He knows what he's doing in it. And he said that he enjoys working with Stephen Moffat and he loves his vision for the show. So I don't think this is going to be someone that comes in and tries to change things around or whatever. He knows what Moffat's doing and he's happy with it. So I don't see too much in the way of changing what's going on so far.
Maybe he'll bring another, perspective, though, coming from things like Torchwood and Sarah Jane.
Yeah, possibly.
But, I mean, so did Moffat, so... I mean, Caro Skinner.
Yeah. So, I don't know. I'm not too worried about this. I think, if we do see stuff, it's going to be minor at best. But we'll see what happens.
Okay. I've come across... I found my my photo cache here. So, in reverse order, first we had the hybrid tech. It was referred to as an electronic OLA anti-time device that was apparently a temporal lock device that could be used to create these. Oh, I'm sorry, QLAs. So it was a quantum lock associator for whatever the hell that means. So, and looking at the thing, it actually has the Dalek eye stalk on the top, and the bottom half of it actually utilizes Cybermen technology, but it's essentially a pistol. The more interesting of the two was the transtemporal sonic screwdriver. And the write-up on the back gives this little backdrop. It says, with the TARDIS trapped on Earth in a transtemporal schism, the Doctor finds himself at the center of four time zones. As with each previous time, the TARDIS generates a new sonic screwdriver for the Doctor, but this time it's created in the style of each time zone: Elizabethan, Victorian, present day, and future London. with additional new features, including a wood setting.
Yay, wood setting!
The Doctor must try and free the TARDIS before time runs out. Does that have any bearing on anything we're going to get? I don't know.
Well, I mean, we've got, you know, clearly present day and slightly future London are easy to accomplish. I mean, but we've got the Victorian era coming up really soon here, and we've seen pictures from the 50th anniversary of a Queen Elizabeth character. Mm-hmm. So, this may be one of those things like the poster displaying the 50th anniversary thing that they didn't want the press to get a hold of.
Right.
It could be one of those things that just slipped under the radar, and Whovians being what they are, you know, pick it apart and figure everything out by reverse engineering it.
So it's out there, and you can get yourself one to add to your screwdriver collection for under $30, and mine is already in my wish list. Or actually, I think I might have ordered it the other night after I had a few, so that's on its way to me, along with a few other items. Oh, and by the way, for those of you who just do need to add to your collection, there have been a number of Third Doctor screwdriver replicas floating around that you can get a hold of, you know, and they've been readily available through through most channels. At the moment, it seems like they do have a slight bumper crop of Fourth Doctor screwdrivers, which is just basically a color variant of the right. predecessor. Yeah. So get a copy of that or get a hold of one of those as well. Still no word on whether they are ever going to do an official Second Doctor replica. You know, being very simplistic, obviously, it's just a light pen and a silver tube and all, but it'd be nice to have one that actually had the BBC's stamp of approval on it.
Mm-hmm.
Wait and see. And then, obviously, the one that we had for the sixth, which was all wonky as hell, nearly chrome plated in its look and feel. But for those of us who are on screwdriver collection kicks,
all you completionists,
exactly, precisely, exactly.
All right. Well, I think that about does it, and we're running a little bit long tonight. So
yeah.
But all right. Well, again, thanks for all the great feedback that we've been getting. And you know, if you guys want to share your thoughts with us, there's plenty of ways to do that. You can find us on Twitter at Gallifrey Radio. We're on Facebook. You can leave iTunes comments. We'd love those. The reviews and comments over there are fantastic. You can email us at feedback@gallifreypublicradio.com. You can go to our website. There's a contact us page there. There's also, if you look in the top right corner, a place to ask questions. So, you know, if you watch the episode and want to know our take on it, you know, just click on that and send us your questions so that we can discuss them just like Soleil did. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, we love getting feedback from you guys. I mean, we thrive on this, and it gives us so much great content to discuss. So please keep that coming in.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I'll continue to stir up the muck to give you people things to get angry about.
All right. Well, this has been episode 36 of Gallifrey Public Radio. Until next week, this is Jay saying that clearly the TARDIS is 98% hallways.
And this is Melissa saying we get to see the Queen of Thorns next episode.
And this is Kira saying, you know, I've always stood by this. Siblings are just right bastards.
We'll see you guys next week.
Bye.
I'll see you.
Thanks for joining us for another episode of Gallifrey Public Radio. Join us each week for new episodes. Have something you need to say, something we got wrong, or something you just need to weigh in on? Send us an email at feedback@gallifreypublicradio.com. You can also find us on Twitter at Gallifrey Radio, on Stitcher Smart Radio under Gallifrey Public Radio. Find us on iTunes, where you can leave us comments and reviews. You can also head over to our homepage at gallifreypublicradio.com, where you can leave comments on each episode and get into discussions on the things that we bring up. You can also keep up to date on all the latest news and what's going on in the community. Music by Beyond the Epilogue and Retcon Addict.
Galsprey Public Radio is copyright 2013.
She's like, he's my doctor, man, back off. The doctor knows, wait. She's like, he's my doctor, man, maybe that's his mom, I don't know, back off.